Yes, the same kind of story seems to come down from long ago. Two friends having coffee together when something flies by their window. It might be out on that lawn, which is wide, at least half of the playing field. Because there's no explaining what your imagination can make you see and feel. Somebody wants my feet.
Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Tonight we have four people on Coast to Coast AM who have tried for at least two decades to find out what the American government knows about the UFO phenomenon and why there has been a policy of denial in the interest of national security since at least the Truman administration. In a moment, our special four-hour roundtable discussion on UFOs. And welcome to our special roundtable discussion on UFOs. I'm George Norrie right here on Coast to Coast AM. U.S. Navy research physicist Bruce McAbee is the author of the UFO FBI Connection, The Secret History of the Government's Cover-Up. Bruce McAbee received his Ph.D. in physics from the American University in Washington, D.C., 1970. He was hired by the U.S. Department of the Navy to be a physics researcher at what was then called the Naval Ordnance Laboratory. The name was later changed to the Naval Surface Warfare Center, the Dahlgren Division, where Dr. McAbee has worked ever since. Dr. McAbee says with FOIA releases and document leaks, we're learning more about what happened years ago than they knew years ago. His website, by the way, you can Google him and find out everything. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. One of our guests then tonight will be Dr. Bruce McAbee. Bruce, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Thank you.
Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
One top secret group appointed by President Harry S. Truman to investigate the UFO phenomenon was called Majestic 12, or MJ-12, in the early 1990s. 35-millimeter negatives were sent by an anonymous source to Don Berliner of the Fund for UFO Research in Maryland. On those negatives were pages of a U.S. War Department training manual entitled Restricted SOMA 1-01 Majestic 12 Group Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal, Top Secret / Magic Eyes Only. The man who began an investigation of that leaked document was Robert M. Wood, Ph.D. On the 35-millimeter film were 32 pages of text and drawings and the fingers of whoever photographed the pages of the top-secret Majestic 12 classified manual. Bob Wood, now retired in California, had a 43-year-long career as an aerospace engineer, first working for Douglas Aircraft that merged with the McDonnell Corporation in 1967 to become the McDonnell Douglas, later purchased by Boeing in the early 1990s. Over those four decades, Bob Wood worked on aerodynamic heating, ballistic missile defense, radar, and the space station before his retirement in 1993. Now, that year, nuclear physicist and UFO researcher Stanton Friedman had seen the 35-millimeter negative in Berliner's possession and contacted Dr. Wood to see if he would be interested in researching what was on that film. He did, and concluded the top-secret government training manual for UFO crash retrieval operations is authentic. Also on the panel tonight, Bob Wood. Hi, Bob. Welcome to Coast as well.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Likewise, too. Also on the document trail is Grant Cameron from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, where he has worked since 1974 as a building facility manager at the University of Manitoba. Now, tonight, Grant is joining us by phone from Kansas City, Missouri, on a visit there to research at the President Truman Library. Grant Cameron has spent a lot of time in American presidential libraries and the National Archives trying to find historic memos and diaries that will connect dates of alleged UFO crashes and meetings between American presidents and military leaders, scientists, and high-ranking administration officials. He has discovered that only two sitting U.S. presidents were ever asked publicly about UFOs. The first time was on July 10, 1948, to President Truman. The second was in 1954 to President Dwight Eisenhower. Tonight we'll learn from Grant what those presidents said and a whole lot more about behind the scenes from the Kennedy to Clinton and current Bush administrations. Grant Cameron. Grant, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Good evening, George.
Good to have you with us. The UFO phenomenon, of course, is not just disc or triangular or cylinder-shaped vehicles that can move in Earth's skies at phenomenal speeds and then immediately stop and hover. Eyewitnesses have described beams coming from the aerial craft which can raise and lower objects, even heavy cows. And all over the world since at least the early 1950s, ranchers have discovered livestock of all kinds, even deer and elk, dead, with tissue and organs cut from their bodies without signs of blood or tracks. One Stanford University graduate and Denver CBS affiliate producer and reporter decided in September of 1979 to investigate the unusual animal deaths and produced a documentary called A Strange Harvest, which received a regional Emmy. In the broadcast, law enforcement linked the mutations to creatures not from this planet. Since then, Linda Moulton Howe has produced hundreds of TV programs, documentaries, radio news segments, four books, and the award-winning website, earthfiles.com. Her news beat is Science, Medicine, the Environment, and Real X-Files. And she has never given up trying to understand the truth about the global animal mutilation mystery. But military and intelligence sources have told her the perpetrators are extraterrestrial biological entities. And where to begin? The four guests suggested going back into time in 1942, 5 years before the famous Roswell controversy, to the night of February 24th, 25th, 1942, when America's 37th Coast Artillery Brigade fired 1,430 anti-aircraft shells at a UFO moving slowly over Santa Monica, California. For tonight's Coast to Coast audience, Linda has posted the very famous Battle of Los Angeles photograph that shows spotlights and artillery fire aimed at the UFO, along with newspaper headlines, a 1942 eyewitness account provided by Bruce Maccabee, and documents that have surfaced about correspondence between President Franklin Roosevelt and his Army Chief of Staff, George C. Marshall. Let's start, of course, with Dr. Wood about what happened in the early morning of February 25th, 1942, and also turn it over now to our friend Linda Moulton Howe.
And thank you, George. This photograph and these amazing documents and this eyewitness description that Bruce Maccabee has provided are right now at earthfiles.com. All you have to do is go to www.earthfiles.com, click on the headlines page at the top. It'll take you to this report and you can look at what we're going to talk about. Going back in time to 1942 to something that really was a surprise to me, that we learned that right after this amazing battle, quote-unquote, Battle of Los Angeles, that President Franklin Roosevelt and his Army Chief of Staff were corresponding within a day after, apparently, there was a disc discovery, and it was described as being of interplanetary nature. And Bob Wood, could you start and explain for the Coast audience who might not know about this amazing 1942 battle that took place right out here over the Santa Monica Mountains, what happened and how did you get those leaked documents and what exactly do they say?
Well, it was a very visible event with thousands of people over the what now is the Los Angeles airport saw this object being fired at by anti-aircraft guns, and this photograph that you describe shows it very clearly. In fact, if you enhance it a little bit, you can actually see the image of a craft inside the searchlights that are illuminating it as the anti-aircraft shells are going off. So these thousands of people saw it, and of course, George Marshall, who was the chief of staff, had to tell the president something, and so he wrote a memo that was secret only, that was a very innocuous memo that said, hey, no bombs were dropped, we fired 1,430 rounds, no casualties, no planes shot down, and nothing lost. However, obviously, there was a secure communication, a phone or telegraph, between him and FDR. Telling FDR something more was important, because that led to a memo that FDR wrote 2 days later on February 27th that said, hey, we're going to consider the disposition of the material in the possession of the Army. And what turns out that a week later, why Marshall wrote a letter that explains it a little bit, and the bottom line is that they recovered one craft in the San Bernardino Mountains, and the Navy salvaged another at sea. So that's really what happened in that week.
And Bob, it says in that document that I'm looking at, not only, quote unquote, the Army Air Corps also recovered a similar object in the San Bernardino Mountains east of Los Angeles, and that's a quote. And another quote, mystery airplanes are in fact not earthly. And according to secret intelligence sources, they are in all probability of interplanetary origin, unquote. If this is in the Marshall-FDR communication that was highly classified, then what you're saying is they already were very skilled in putting out the innocuous document the day after on channels that were not secure.
Exactly right. They did, however, classify it secret, which was basically a cover to make people think that it was, you know, the real thing.
And in my research, I've learned 6 people died, 3 from a heart attack, 3 apparently from a variety of things like a crash, something falling on them. As you pointed out, and as Bruce McAbee in supplying that eyewitness account, Bruce, maybe you could go a little further with looking at this photograph, which at earthfiles.com, it is enhanced, and you can see what looks like the shape that the eyewitness used, lozenge, which is almost diamond shape.
Yeah, right. Actually, you can get some other views if you on the Coast to Coast AM front page there. If you click on my name, Bruce McAbee, that'll take you to my website where you can look at further enhancements. It's a interesting situation that you have these beams from several different searchlights shooting up into the sky, and you can see where the light from the beam is, indicating that there's dust or smoke in the sky. So that reflects the beam, and that's how you can see the beam of light traveling through the atmosphere because of light bouncing off the particulate matter in the atmosphere, and it gets up to this region where the object is. All the beams converge. They all seem to stop about at the object. None of them really go past it. And if you look at the picture with varying amounts of enhancement on the picture, you can see that there seems to be something there which is almost like absorbing light or preventing the light from traveling through it, at very least. You also see little bright spots, which we presume are the explosions going off and bombs bursting up there near the object. They would be creating smoke as well as the powder, the shell powder burns. So there would be the object up there with a lot of smoke around it. The story is this object took only 30 minutes to travel about 20 miles, 25 miles. So it was going rather slowly, giving them plenty of time to zero in on it and fire their guns.
And Bruce, isn't it remarkable that if you take the time from the newspapers, the whole incident lasted about 38 minutes. This, whatever it was that was taking all this artillery round, went unscathed in the sky, and yet there had to have been thousands of people out there watching Why do you think that there was so far only one photograph surfaced?
Well, I don't know. How many people would have had cameras out there to take photographs? But with the one photograph that we have taken by a news reporter, the reporter, as I understand it, had to leave his house and travel to some location. At that time, Los Angeles was in blackout condition, so you drove along. If you did drive, you drove with your lights out.
And Bruce, wasn't that because the air raid sirens had started going off and on February 24th to the 25th, and there was an order to black out all of the lights from a part of Santa Monica all the way down past, I think, to San Diego?
Yeah, I think the order came out something like 2 hours before they actually started firing at something, implying that for some reason or other they may have had a heads up that something was coming. I don't know. It's just a guess on my part, but the city was already blacked out when they started firing. And you can read it at your website, Earthfiles. You can read the testimony of Scott Littleton, a witness who was 8 years old. There are also several accounts in newspapers, stories that were published at the time. Scott Littleton's account has just been available recently in the last couple of years, where he has written down what he recalls of it. But everybody recalls this thing moving along very slowly, some orangish or maybe reddish color associated with it.
And all of this artillery round that was hitting at it. And Bruce, I wonder if it is worth asking the Coast audience, if who might be listening, and they might have been 8, 7, 8, 9 years old, whether or not they might have scrapbooks or old family albums. Maybe if we put out a request for people to look into old family albums going back to 42, could somebody out there have another photograph of this amazing event in which our government was firing at an unidentified object that was then related within the next 4 to 5 days in correspondence between the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and his Army Chief of Staff about a crash retrieval and the word interplanetary?
And Linda, do we know what happened to the object as it slowly drifted? Did it just disappear? Is that what happened?
It faded out, right, Bruce?
I guess. I mean, it's not the information we have is primarily comes from newspaper stories at the time, and anybody who does research work realizes that newspaper stories tend to be truncated. They never tell everything. Whether this thing got out of range of the spotlights and faded in that way, or whether it was still in range of the spotlights and it somehow faded out, we don't know. Apparently the shell firing occurred for about half an hour.
Right. It's
and 30... then the people who were there, remember, you know, it lasted in a certain amount of time, then it stopped, and everybody assumed, well, that's all over. It would be really nice if there were somebody who was actually operating one of the guns, or somebody who was really involved directly with this, that could come up with some information that has been, you know, they may have been keeping quiet for years or whatever.
Yeah, please get in touch with us. We can go to Coast, Earthfiles at earthfiles.com. Anybody who might have
they
more
information. They can fast blast us too, Linda.
Yes.
Immediately, right now.
Yes, we really would like more information on this. And I have a very important question to ask Grant Cameron. But before I move in that direction, Bob, I wondered if anything else has come up in any other documents that have even suggested what might have happened to this object that is described in the George Marshall document to President Roosevelt, saying that the object that was retrieved in the San Bernardino Mountains was similar. It's referring to the battle over Los Angeles. It sounds like another object that they think is similar to what was being shot at and is in all of those spotlights. Any idea where it went after it was retrieved?
Well, the straightforward answer to your question is I have no documents that would shed light on that very good question. However, it is interesting, you know, you're talking about the idea of getting witnesses earlier, and yesterday I gave a talk to a group about UFOs, and I'm going to have lunch with a guy who was actually woke up and saw the firing when he was here in Santa Monica. And so these kinds of people, I think, actually are good ones to ask the question of the photographs.
Well, we will find out very shortly. We'll continue our roundtable discussion along with Linda Moulton Howe and our very special guests tonight, Bruce McApee, Bob Wood, of course, and Grant Cameron. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505. City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And of course, Linda Moulton Howe joining me, and we're going to have a special four-hour discussion tonight on UFOs with this roundtable discussion. So it is not a three-hour, in case you're just joining us. It's going to go a full 4 hours, so stay with us. I'll tell you what also goes for hours and hours, the After Dark CD. You get two CDs. And that's 2.5 hours of bumper music, unforgettable calls to the show, and some ghost stories. A couple ways to pick up the CD. Of course, there's a toll-free number, 1-800-598-2331, 1-800-598-2331. And they tell me the simple way now, because we're getting to the end of this for a while, it's to go to this website, afterdarkcd.com. That's afterdarkcd.com. Linda, we're going to borrow the Battle of Los Angeles photograph, put it on the coasttocoastam.com website until your crashed surfer comes back.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Well, you've got a couple million people trying to squeeze in. It's like a funnel.
Well, you know, this would be a good time also.
Can I make a comment?
You sure can.
If you go to the brewmac.8k.com website, which is basically just clicking on my name, on your Coast to Coast AM website.
You're just taking the words right out of my mouth, Bruce.
You scroll down the front page there. It says at the top, Dr. Bruce McApee Research website. You scroll down a ways, and you'll see the battle of a bunch of sightings listed, including the Battle of Los Angeles. And if you click on that, a paragraph says Battle of Los Angeles. Here are some processed images and so on.
Should come right up.
And you click on that, and you'll see my analysis, and you'll see the original photo and several processed versions of it make it somewhat clearer as to what's apparently inside that glowing, what seems to be a glowing region where all the beams converge.
And Bruce,
and also you get some calculations as to how big this thing might be. I had figured that if it was 1,000 feet away, it would be 40 feet wide. But there were some claims in the newspapers that it was at an altitude of 8,000 feet. If it were at an altitude of 8,000 feet, then it would probably have been 10,000 feet maybe from the spotlights, and that would make it something like maybe 400 or maybe even larger, 500 or 600 feet wide.
Really huge.
Yes.
And Bruce, I wanted to give out your website, Bob's and Grant's, and just to repeat now, the Battle of Los Angeles photograph, it's at brumac.8k.com. And Bob Wood, all of the Majestic 12 documents are at www.majesticdocuments.com. And Grant Cameron's work on American presidents and what they know is at www.presidentialufo.com. And my website, which apparently has malfunctioned, is earthfiles.com. So keep visiting that in the next few days, because I'm going to have more reports following up this roundtable tonight. But one thing, George, is, as Bruce is saying, this could be a very large object. And if we were putting a 1,400 and some rounds of artillery,
you're bound to hit it.
Exactly.
If it's solid.
And if it was, then it must have had some kind of a field maybe around it that was deflecting. And following this whole idea that even in the FDR and Marshall correspondence, they used the term interplanetary. Well, it turns out in September of 1947, which would then be 5.5 years later, in what Bob Wood and his son Ryan have bound together in their documents, this one is called the White Hot Majestic 12 document. It says, with the passage of the National Security Act of 1947 and the historical discovery of extraterrestrial hardware and live extraterrestrial creatures has presented an unprecedented situation with regard to maintaining secrecy related to the information contained in this report in the early months of 1942 up until the present. Intrusions of unidentified aircraft have occasionally been documented. And then it goes on about the recovery of another craft in 1941. And that apparently is because there's a part of this document that refers to it and then blocks out the word Missouri. That's the famous
Cape Girardeau case.
Cape Girardeau. And Bob Wood, just because I'm going to go to Grant and let him talk here, I'm curious, Bob, is there anything new that has developed on Cape Girardeau beyond the fact that the Majestic 12 documents describe what seems to have been what they called a neutronic propulsion system or power plant? And the assumption from the Majestic 12 white paper is that it came from Missouri and that particular crash, retrieval in 1941.
Well, it's not clear which crash the information came from, but it was in the document you're talking about, the White Hot Report. But I think it was very significant that you noted very properly that in the early months of 1942, are mentioned in the same sentence as the recovery case of 1941.
Right.
Thereby giving exceptional credence to the Los Angeles air raid event being the source of a couple of more crashes. I think that's very significant.
I wonder if they ended up crashing because they might have been damaged from all that artillery fire.
Oh, I believe that's the obvious assumption that I have made, but I have no further evidence in the form of documents that says that's what happened. We're really, actually, if you piece together the timeline for the Los Angeles air raid events, you have the air raid, and then you have a missing piece of information, some sort of a secure phone or telegraph between Marshall and FDR that caused him to write the memo 2 days later, saying how important it was. And then there was clearly a special intelligence unit created, according to Marshall, presumably the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, that we'll probably talk about a little later. And there was also a missing memo creating the Special Committee on Non-Terrestrial Science and Technology that worked during the war, trying to figure out what to do with these recovered craft.
And, Bob, if, in fact, we already had retrieved technology in a craft and maybe bodies from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, in 1941, then whatever happened in Los Angeles, there were units that were operating with intelligence about what they were dealing with. And this leads a question to Grant Cameron. Grant, you have done so much research into archives, trying to understand what American administrations have understood about an extraterrestrial biological entity presence in their technology. Could you find anything that would support links around crash retrievals? And I know that there is a name that you have found was playing behind the scenes that a lot of people might not know about, and that is James Webb. Could you take that name and kind of string for us what you know now, jumping from 1942 up to where James Webb starts to play a role?
Okay, but maybe first I can make a couple of comments on the 42 incident, because I did deal with the FDR library on this. And I think you have to keep in mind, in terms of this, that it happened only a couple months after Pearl Harbor. So the Americans were greatly on edge, especially on the West Coast. And the two documents, the only two that were released by the Roosevelt Library are the one from Marshall to the President, and then from the President to his Secretary of War, Stimson. These are found in separate files. They're not in the same file. And we know that the Navy, the Secretary of the Navy was also involved. This is a story that ran, I think, five days in a row on the front page of the LA Times. And the Navy guy was involved. And one other thing I should mention is that the memo from Marshall to the President mentions 15 objects. It doesn't mention just one. So that's something that I think has to be taken into consideration, that there may have been more than one object flying around. And the other thing I had mentioned to Ryan, Bob's son, that there was an audio tape. Now, I don't have the details with me, but there is an audio tape around where one of the people there talks about a crash. I believe he was one of the people in the military there doing the shooting. And there is an audio tape where a crash is also described. And the final thing I'd like to mention is it's just one of only three crashes. You've got the 41 Missouri crash. You've got this rumored story of a crash. And you also have a story with Cordell Hull, who was this Secretary of State. And there's a story running around that he may have shown his cousin bodies and a craft under the Capitol in 1939. So there may have been a number of different crashes that FDR handled, and I think it's important to keep in mind that FDR was very good at secrecy. In fact, there's a famous story that's been told numerous times now that his Vice President Truman wasn't even briefed on the bomb, on the fact that they had an atomic bomb. He didn't get briefed on that until about 12 days after he was took over as the President. So FDR was very good at keeping secrets, and he was working in an atmosphere unlike Truman and all the presidents after that, in which the media was not a big factor. It was UFOs, crashes, this wasn't a popular sort of topic. The media wasn't on it, so they could do a lot of this stuff in total secrecy, mm-hmm. whereas once 1947 came along, you had a situation where the president, this is in the front page of the newspaper all the time, there was questions being asked, and they were in a situation where they had to deal with it publicly.
And that's why they went into really an enforced policy of lying, really, under oath almost, in order to perpetuate national security and keep the peace and protect, keep people from panicking while they tried to figure out what they were dealing with.
Yeah, because if you look at the case of Roswell, they had a major leak. This thing was starting to go across the wire services, and they had to shut this thing down.
Well, what about this man, James Webb?
James Webb, I'll tell you the story. I was at the Truman Library the last couple of days, and I sort of got on Webb, and some of this may be just absolute coincidence, but it's very bizarre. I first came across James Webb dealing with the Kecksburg crash in 1965 under President Johnson. And if you were to make a list of all the people that should come to the president after a crash, the 1965 case, the day after the crash, everybody that should have been there was at the president's ranch. And one of the people that was there was James Webb, who was at that time was the head of NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And he flew into the ranch the morning after. And the reason it became important was because I talked to Stan Gordon, who was the chief researcher of the Kecksburg crash, and I asked him, I said, you know, based on who was there, and he mentioned two units, according to all the eyewitness testimony they had, and the one was the Air Force, and of course the head of the Air Force was at the ranch the next morning. The other one, he said, and he had a number of witnesses that said that NASA had been involved. And so it was very sort of timely that the director of NASA would appear at the president's ranch at 9:45 the next morning. And so that's where it started. And then when I was looking on different things, I was at the Truman Library, I suddenly came across the fact that James Webb was also in the Truman administration. He had two different positions. He was the Undersecretary of State at one point, and he was also the Director of the Budget. And strangely found out that he had been in the President's office July the 7th, the day before the famous Roswell story broke. He was in the President's office the day after, and he was also in the President's office on the 10th. So he was there. When I was last week, I was speaking at the Ozark, and I was talking to Scott Ramsey, who's working on the Aztec crash. So I got the date of the Aztec crash. So I went to the Truman Library, and I, of course, looked up, and that's the way I do it. I go in and I look at the president's schedule and the people around the president. Where was everybody? Is there any coincidence that the right people are in the right places? And 2 days after the Aztec crash, or the reported date of the Aztec crash, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were all in the President's office. So the Secretary of Defense was in the office, Secretary of Navy was in the office, Secretary of the Air Force was in the office, and Sidney Sewers, who is one of the people named on the MJ-12 document, he was the Executive Secretary of the National Security Council at the time, was in the office, and so was James Webb at the same time, so 2 days after.
And the date that I think that Scott is using, based on his interviews with the families of the police officers who described and said that they saw that big silver disc on Hart Canyon up there on the mesa, they said it was somewhere like around March 15, 16, 17th of 1948. Which date were you using?
I was using the 21st.
21st.
21st. That was the date that I had gotten.
In March of 1948.
And then to go on for more coincidences, this is something that perhaps Bruce McAbee can talk about, because he's done a lot of study on this. December the 6th, 1950, there was a UFO alert, and there was a rumored crash on the U.S.-Mexican border. And on that date, when I was researching that, I got the phone records, all the phone records inside the president's office and inside the White House. And James Webb made about almost a dozen phone calls, starting 10 minutes after the alert was called. He phoned Sidney Sewers again, who then was consultant on military and foreign affairs. He was talking to the deputy for defense. He was talking to J. Edgar Hoover. My. Just one phone call after another. He talked to George Marshall. It was just one after another. And this is within about 3 or 4 hours after he made all these phone calls. And he just seems to pop up at almost every single crash. He seems to be there.
And Grant, just for clarification, does he begin with the Truman administration? He doesn't go back to FDR, does he?
No, he doesn't go back to FDR, although there is another strange coincidence there. He was a Marine pilot in the 1930s. And he was very good friends, got his pilot's license almost the same time, and was close friends with Lloyd Berkner from the 1930s. And Lloyd Berkner also appears on the MJ-12 as one of the MJ-12 people. But he starts in the Truman administration, and he goes all the way up into the Johnson administration, which is another strange thing that we have the case of Kennedy sending out the famous National Security Action Memorandum 10 days before he's assassinated. And in that memorandum released by the Kennedy people, it talks about the fact that James Webb had been given a mission by the president to go and release outer space material with the Russians. And I think Bob Wood has a document that was leaked to them, which goes farther to say that UFO material was involved in trying. They wanted this released to the Russians.
Linda, Bob, we're not going to have time to talk because we're going to approach the top of the hour.
We can pick that up after.
And also, what I want to find out when we talk to our guests when we come back is why they think there is no disclosure. Because there's a bigger picture here. There's a reason why the government is holding back. And I don't think it's just national security anymore. There's something else going on.
There's a lot to that question. And also, to all three of you, why do you think these disks were crashing all over the place? Because we've just heard a whole bunch.
Seems like we've
bunch.
Had many of them. And you would think that anything that had the kind of technology to get here, whether they popped through wormholes or came from motherships, that they wouldn't be that technologically weak to crash all the time. There's something strange about that as well. I also want to ask you, Linda, and I want you to think about this and pose this to our panel. If they believe, because I haven't heard this come up very often, if we're dealing with hostilities here,
yes,
if we're dealing with entities, extraterrestrials that aren't coming here for the benefit of mankind, if you coin a phrase from the old Twilight Zone movie, to serve man, what do they really want to do with us?
And it may be that they don't have hostility, but that we approach them with aggression and there was retaliation. And that is a big part of this question
mark.
Yeah, but
then we look at the research you've done with animal mutilations. To me, if it's being done by extraterrestrials,
why?
That is a very, very strange thing.
And it makes it very difficult for the government to talk.
Absolutely. So we'll be back with our full panel, our roundtable discussion, which has three more hours to go. We're going to keep the doors open tonight.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.